your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Okay, guys, welcome back to Behind the Knife's Absite Review Series. I hope studying is going well, and you guys are prepared to dominate the Absite. Once again, please check out the Behind the Knife podcast companion available on Amazon. Just either search for Absite or search for Behind the Knife, and you'll see it.
And again, this is the second edition with updated clinical practice guidelines and illustrations. There will be a link to the new book in the show notes below.
Follow us on Facebook. Check us out on Twitter. We have a YouTube channel. It really helps if you guys, you know, subscribe to the things that we're putting out and leave us reviews. Let us know what you like, what we don't like, what you don't like, what we can do better. Okay, let's get started.
And welcome back to another Behind the Knife Absite Review. Today we have Jason Bingham, Wudo, and myself, Kevin Canary, taking us through parathyroid.
Make sure you get our podcast companion, which can be found on Amazon.
Yep. So parathyroid, as always, starting with some high yield anatomy. So superior and inferior parathyroids. What can you tell me first off about the superior parathyroids?
Yeah. So the superior parathyroids are posterior and lateral to the recurrent laryngeal nerve, and they originate from the fourth pharyngeal pouch. So think superior is a bigger number for it's important because when you look at the inferior parathyroids, they are anterior and medial to the recurrent laryngeal nerve, and they originate from the third pharyngeal pouch. The inferior glands are more variable in terms of their position, and the thymus also migrates with the third pharyngeal pouch.
Yeah, and the way I remember that is, you know, the inferior ones are traveling all the way from the third pharyngeal pouch all the way down to the inferior of the gland. So they have to travel further. So therefore, they're the most, they end up in the craziest location. So they're the most variable. Kevin, we mentioned this in one of the other reviews, but what supplies blood to both the inferior and superior parathyroids?
That'll be the inferior thyroid artery supplies blood to all four glands in 80% of cases. And this comes off the thyrocervical trunk, which is on the subclavian artery.
Perfect. So parathyroids, unfortunately, there's a whole lot of physiology involved in what the parathyroids do. So Wu, what can you tell me a little bit about what the parathyroids release and what the function is?
Right. So you want to think about two types of cells. The first are the chief cells and the second are the parafollicular C cells. The chief cells of the parathyroid release parathyroid hormone, PTH, in response to low levels of calcium, whereas the parafollicular C cells release calcitonin in response to high levels of calcium. Bear in mind that though the parafollicular C cells are actually located in the thyroid, whereas the chief cells are located in the parathyroids.
Perfect. So Kevin, tell us a little bit about, so we're talking a little bit about calcium metabolism and regulation of calcium. Another important factor when it comes to our calcium levels is vitamin D. You'll see this every once in a while. It'll ask you how we absorb our vitamin D, where it's synthesized, where it goes on different modifications in the body. Can you walk us kind of through that vitamin D process?
So vitamin D is ingested or synthesized in its precursor form. It is then hydroxylated at the 25 position in the liver and then at the 1 position in the kidney.
Yep. And that's where it becomes its more most active form. So, you know, you ingest it and then, or it's synthesized and then it goes to the liver. It's hydroxylated at the 25 position. And then it goes to the kidney with the 1 alpha hydroxylase and it's hydroxylated at the 1 position. And that point, it's at its most active. Now let's talk about the different actions of these different hormones and how they work in the body. So Wu, first off, the parathyroid hormone. What are the actions of the parathyroid hormone?
Yeah, so there are two sites that the parathyroid hormone is acting on. The first is the bone. The PTH stimulates osteoclasts for resorption of calcium and phosphate. The second site is the kidneys. The PTH there stimulates resorption of calcium, inhibits resorption of phosphate and bicarb, and stimulates the conversion of the 25-OH vitamin D to the more active form of the 1,25-OH vitamin D.
And with questions with PTH, you always have to remember that it's the phosphate trashing hormone. So people with hyperparathyroidism will have very low phosphates until they go into kidney failure, at which point their phosphate will be high. But for the most part, people with high PTH will have really low phosphate.
Okay. And Kevin, so you talked a little about vitamin D, how it's synthesized. Once it becomes that active, one, it's hydroxylated at the one position at the kidney, and it becomes that active 1,25 hydroxy, you know, vitamin D. What happens there?
So in the gut, it actually stimulates absorption of calcium and phosphate. And where you get the phosphate trashing, as I just referred to that, that's at the kidney. So at the kidney, the PTH encourages wasting of phosphate, but in the gut, it actually, you get absorption of calcium and phosphate.
Yep. So, you know, parathyroid hormone stimulates the resorption of calcium and phosphate from the bone, resorption of calcium, excretion of phosphate to the kidneys, activates vitamin D. Vitamin D goes and increases the absorption of both calcium and phosphate in the gut. What about calcitonin, Wu?
So calcitonin, I like to think of as something that tones down calcium. In the bone, calcitonin inhibits osteoclast bone resorption. And in the kidney, the calcitonin also inhibits resorption of calcium and phosphate.
Yep. So a lot of feedback loops going on here. Calcium or calcitonin kind of does, you know, the opposite effect of parathyroid hormone. Important to note is that the receptor is on the osteoclast for both parathyroid hormone and calcitonin. So parathyroid hormone stimulates osteoclast to resorb bone, whereas calcitonin inhibits the osteoclast. And so that the osteoblast can do their work. But this,
interesting. So it doesn't stimulate the osteoblast.
It does not stimulate the osteoblast. It inhibits the osteoclast. And that is a question I've seen. So the receptor for both hormones is on the osteoclast. All right, let's talk a little bit about some pathophysiology scenarios. So, Kevin, hypercalcemia, common clinical presentation. Tell me a little bit about how it most commonly presents.
A lot of times it's just found on labs as a high calcium level. If it's an extremely high calcium level, you want to be concerned about malignancy.
Yep. So it's most common, you know, in the outpatient setting, a lot of times they'll break these patients up. They're hypercalcemic. Either they come in, it's incidentally found on labs, or they're severely hypercalcemic and it's found in the inpatient setting. So what's the most common cause of hypercalcemia in the outpatient setting?
Primary hyperparathyroidism.
Exactly. Primary hyperparathyroidism. How about in the, you know, inpatient, you know, very high level setting?
That's where you're going to see the malignancies causing hypercalcemia.
So interesting, with the malignancies cause hypercalcemia, what's the most common cause of that? Is it, you know, a parathyroid cancer that's releasing parathyroid hormone, or is it other cancers that are releasing something else?
Right. No, the most common is squamous cell cancer of the lung that leads to hypercalcemia by stimulating parathyroid hormone. You can also see it in breast cancer. And then lytic bone lesions is a less common malignant cause of hypercalcemia.
Yeah. So it's actually most common by a parathyroid hormone related protein. This not necessarily parathyroid hormone itself, but a mimic. So a parathyroid hormone related protein released from things like squamous cell lung cancer, or breast cancer. The actual lysis from metastasis to the bone is a less common cause of hypercalcemia. So a lot of times these patients with a malignancy will present in hypercalcemic crisis. How do you treat that?
So first you're going to treat with just fluids, and initially it's just going to be normal saline. You're going to run it around 300 cc's an hour. And once the patient becomes euvolemic, then you can add on Lasix.
Yep. So they'll give you a couple different fluid choices, normal saline, lactated Raynors. What are you going to choose and why?
So you're going to avoid the LR because LR contains calcium?
Correct. Yeah. So they're in hypercalcemic crisis. It doesn't make sense to give them a fluid with calcium in it. So initially, 300 mLs an hour of normal saline, and then you can add some Lasix in there. Kevin, we mentioned that the most common cause of hypercalcemia in the outpatient setting is primary hyperparathyroidism. Tell us a little bit about that. What's the most common cause, how do you diagnose this?
The vast majority of primary hyperparathyroidism is from a single adenoma. Occasionally, 2 to 5% of the time, they can have a double adenoma, but 90% of cases are going to be from an adenoma. Some of the other causes are hyperplasia, where all four parathyroids will actually be increased in size and excreting extra hormone. And then very rarely, you can have parathyroid cancer as a cause of this. And then obviously MEN1 and 2A are also causes of hyperparathyroidism.
Yep. So the vast majority is going to be secondary to an adenoma. Second most common, a distant second would be hyperplasia. Tell me a little bit about the laboratory workup of how you diagnose a primary hyperparathyroidism.
So generally, if you have a patient that comes in that has elevated calcium, you're going to then do a urine collection on them and get a 24-hour collection of the urine, where you'll see increased calcium and decreased FOS.
We already mentioned it.
Except in renal failure.
We'll have an increased phosphorus as well.
Right. And prolonged hyperparathyroidism can lead to renal failure. It's damaging to the kidneys, but so you'll see, you'll do a urine study, see increased 24-hour calcium, and then you'll obviously see an elevated serum PTH. And
before I do want to reiterate one point that we should have mentioned earlier. We talked about all the different, effects on, you know, calcium and phosphorus between the kidneys and the bone and the GI tract from vitamin D and calcium and parathyroid hormone. What's the overall effect with an elevated parathyroid hormone level? What's the overall effect of calcium and of phosphate?
Increases the calcium and decreases the phosphate.
Correct. So even though you're absorbing some phosphate from the bone, you're absorbing some from the GI tract, your kidney is excreting it at a higher rate. So the overall blood effect of elevated parathyroid hormone is increased calcium and decreased phos, except, as you already mentioned, in cases of renal failure. Okay, so we have the 24-hour urine collection. Where else do we go for the laboratory studies?
You're going to check their PTH, which seems pretty obvious, and that will be elevated. And then one of the most specific indicators of hyperparathyroidism, and this comes up for whatever reason, is the chloride to phosphorus ratio. So you're dumping phosphorus, and you're going to have a hyperchloremic state in patients that are have hyperparathyroidism. So you're going to get a very high chloride to phosphate ratio. And the number to remember is 33. So chloride to phosphate ratio of 33 is very specific for primary hyperparathyroidism.
Okay. Yep, exactly. And that's, that comes up. That's a testable, you know, question. Is you think about it, your kidney's excreting phosphorus, secreting a negatively charged ion. It has to reabsorb something to balance that out, which is chloride. So you have an elevated chloride to phos ratio of 33 or greater. Another useful laboratory test is you'll see an increase in the urinary calcium as it spills over and is excreted, as well as increased urinary cyclic AMP, secondary messenger for the resorption of calcium and the excretion of FOS. So you have your diagnosis. We mentioned that, you know, the most common cause of a primary hyperparathyroidism is a adenoma. How do you localize the adenoma?
Absolutely. So in the vast majority of cases, we're looking for that single adenoma. You can break apart localization studies to non-invasive and invasive modalities. For the non-invasive ones, you could use ultrasound, sestamibi scans, single photon emission CTs or SPECT, and MRI. Of these, the best is likely a sestamibi with a SPECT plus or minus the ultrasound. And as far as invasive studies go, you can use angiography with venous sampling for PTH gradients. And this is generally reserved for reoperative cases.
Yeah, I don't think you'd see that too much on the test, but definitely knowing that the sestamibi and the, you know, the SPECT with ultrasound for localization is highly effective in the vast majority of cases. You know, if you've already done your resection, you still can't find it, you know, then the more invasive, lesser common tests like angiography and selective sampling is an option. But I doubt that you would see that on a test.
Yeah, many times is all you need is an ultrasound or possibly sestamibi.
Correct. Yep. Treatment. Kevin.
So this is a very easily treated condition with a parathyroidectomy. And nowadays, they're pretty much recommending almost most people that have hyperparathyroidism should be considered for a parathyroidectomy. So indications in patients, a lot of these, especially nowadays with increased lab monitoring of patients, you're going to have a lot of patients that are asymptomatic. They just get an elevated calcium on one of their blood tests. So which of these patients, per the ABSITE should have their parathyroid removed? So if their elevation of their serum calcium is 1 mg/dL or more over a normal value, just that alone is an indication. If they have a decreased creatinine clearance, as we said, prolonged hypercalcemia can cause kidney damage. So if they have a decreased creatinine clearance less than 60, they should also have a parathyroidectomy. If they have osteoporosis, if their T-score is less than 2.5, taking out their parathyroid gland will actually improve their osteoporosis. So they should have that treated. If this is a patient that has poor access to care and follow-up, you should consider just taking out the parathyroid. It's just generally the cause that surgeons use to operate. And then if they're less than 50, if they're young, if they're going to be having hyperparathyroidism for a long time, there's systemic effects, which they should have a parathyroidectomy to prevent. And then, like I said, some argue all patients with hyperparathyroidism, but generally you'll have one of these indications for the ABSITE.
Yep. So again, all symptomatic patients, no question, they should undergo surgery. And then those indications you listed, this is a common PIMP question on rounds is, you know, what are the indications for parathyroidectomy in the asymptomatic patient? So again, quickly, elevation of serum calcium, 1 over the normal value based on your laboratory, decreased creatinine clearance, T-score less than 2.5. If they have poor access to follow-up, you can go ahead and take them out. Age less than 50. And as Kevin mentioned, there's more and more push for, you know, taking these out. It's a safe surgery. We're starting to understand the negative impact of having a prolonged elevated PTH, even if it's asymptomatic and you don't necessarily meet these criteria. There's more and more pushes to take these out. More and more liberal use of parathyroidectomy. But for the boards, for the ABSITE, I would stick with those indications. Now, intraoperatively, Wu, how do you know, you do your localization studies, you think you know, you think you got your target for adenoma. How do you confirm that intraoperatively once you've done the parathyroidectomy?
So the key is to measure a rapid PTH assay, and you're going to compare that against the baseline before the removal of the parathyroid gland. And you want to see a 50% drop in the parathyroid hormone level.
Right. 50% drop intraoperatively. And at what time period, Kevin?
It was like 10 minutes after you remove it.
Yeah, it has a very short half-life. So yeah,
it's pretty amazing. And then if it doesn't have that drop, that's when you are going to have to go searching other sites to identify the parathyroid.
Okay. How about so that's if you have a single adenoma. How about if you go into it and you have multi-gland disease? Wu, how do you treat these patients?
So these patients require a subtotal parathyroidectomy. That means 3.5 glands, or a total parathyroidectomy with reimplantation into the sternocleidomastoid or the brachioradialis muscle.
Okay. And bonus points. So you're doing your 3.5 gland resection. Do you resect the three glands first, or do you resect your half gland first?
You want to start with the half gland.
Right. So you take out three perfectly normal, or you take out three good glands, and you go take out your half one, you realize you devascularize it and you're left with nothing. So yeah, do your half gland resection first.
And I could see this coming up as a question where they give you a system EB scan and they say a patient has hypercalcemia, and the system EB lights up all four glands, and they ask you what surgery would you do for this patient, and that is when you choose what we just discussed.
That's a great question. I think you should probably start writing questions for the boards, Kevin.
Sign me up.
Okay, so that's primary hyperthyroidism. Kevin, what's secondary hyperparathyroidism?
So secondary hyperparathyroidism is in patients that are in renal failure. So as we discussed earlier, you can't have the hydroxylization to the 125 vitamin D. So you have low calcium. And so your parathyroid hormone increases, it increases to such a point that it causes problems. So it does increase calcium, but then you do have other side effects. And this is generally just treated by giving the patient calcium and vitamin D supplements. and that will help decrease their need for excess PTH. And then a lot of times they'll be on a renal diet and FOS binders.
Yeah, as we talked about, these are all feedback loops. So, you know, if you have renal failure, you're not able to, you know, activate your vitamin D, you're going to have persistently elevated levels of PTH. That's going to cause bone resorption. That's going to cause further problems. And so you have to treat that with calcium and vitamin D supplements. So Wu, we talked about primary, we talked about secondary. What's tertiary?
So now take that patient who had secondary hyperparathyroidism. They go on to get a renal transplant and they continue to have high production of PTH despite the renal transplant. That is tertiary hyperparathyroidism.
Yeah. So you have your parathyroid hormones, which are constantly stimulated for years and years and years. All of a sudden you get a renal transplant, but they're still amped up. So they're still producing high levels of PTH. How do you treat those?
So for these patients, you can do a subtotal parathyroidectomy or a subtotal with autotransplantation.
Correct. So that covers our primary, secondary, tertiary. Again, a lot of feedback loops. Once you spend a little time trying to understand the pathophysiology, they all start make sense and they're easy to remember. So finally, let's talk about parathyroid tumor or parathyroid cancer. We mentioned before, it's a very rare cause of hyperparathyroidism. But how do they typically present, Kevin?
So these patients will have calciums of about 15, extremely high, whereas all these other calciums will be around 11, and they may have a palpable mass.
Yeah, so this is something nice in the stem of the question. They'll probably give you somebody with an extremely high calcium, maybe comes in a hypercalcemic crisis, they have a palpable neck mass, biopsy it as parathyroid cancer. How do you treat these?
This is an in-block resection with ipsilateral thyroid and central neck dissection.
Yep. So you take out that, you know, you take out the tumor, you take out the ipsilateral thyroid, and you do a central neck dissection. How about recurrences, metastasis, or let's say they have recurrence, or let's say they have widely metastatic disease. How are they treated?
Unfortunately, chemo rads are not effective for parathyroid cancer for the most part. So you're going to do palliative surgery and then give them calcium lowering drugs such as bisphosphonates.
Great. So this is one of those cancers where even with metastasis, you might get a resection, as a palliative measure. Okay. So that's a good quick overview of parathyroids, the most highly testable questions. We'll move on now to our quick hit session.
We should have warned our listeners to not be driving during that session for fear of falling asleep.
Oh yeah. Sorry. A lot of physiology in this one, but we tried to keep it pertinent. So quick hits. All right. So Wu, you have a high normal range serum. So high normal calcium, elevated PTH, and evidence of bone loss.
So this patient is normal calcemic and has hyperparathyroidism. So normal calcemic hyperparathyroidism, it's an early form of primary hyperparathyroidism, and surgery is indicated if the patient is symptomatic.
Right. And I think this speaks to us, you know, going more and more towards, you know, doing resection, that some of these might be a little bit subclinical. The calcium may just be on the upper end of normal there, but they have an abnormally elevated PTH, and there is long-term consequences to that. So
one thing we never discussed is what symptomatic means.
That's a great question. So, Kevin, what are the symptoms of hypercalcemia?
So I think the one you're going to see most frequently is kidney stones. So you have stones, moans, and groans.
Osteoporosis
groans. Would be one, bone fractures, and then abdominal pain. You can just have kind of like a generalized abdominal pain from hypercalcemia. But yeah, so kidney stones and osteoporosis are two of the more common symptomatic patients.
Or even depression. You can have a lot of, neurologic. I think that's part of this.
Can't forget the psychiatric
overtones. So I think it most commonly presents with actually just a depression. So
I'm going to check a lot more calciums.
Especially here in the Pacific Northwest. So Kevin, So again, we talked about this a little bit, but some of the electrolyte disturbances you find with hyperparathyroidism.
Right. So you're going to have the hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis due to the PTH effect on the bicarb excretion in the kidney. And that's also what leads to your chloride to FOS ratio elevated at what, Wu?
Greater than 33.
Perfect.
Then you can also, as we've discussed, PTH is phosphate trashing hormone, so you get hypophosphatemia. And then we've beat this into the ground, but if you have renal impairment, it can still be elevated.
Okay, so Wu, this is very commonly tested. So you have a patient who has an elevated parathyroid hormone, elevated calcium, so that's by definition hyperparathyroidism, but they have a low urinary calcium. What's the diagnosis?
This is benign familial hypocalciuric hypercalcemia.
Yeah. And what's the, what? Why does that occur? Do you know? So basically this, their set point is just higher. So they needed a higher level of parathyroid hormone in order to activate the receptors in their cell. It has, it's a, you know, at one point I used to know the genetic receptor or the component of that, but I don't anymore. I just know that they have a higher set point. But it's not spilling over into their urine, so it's not really causing any problems. What do you do for that?
Nothing.
That's very important. Like, just because they give you somebody that has elevated parathyroid hormone, just because they give you somebody that has elevated calcium, make sure you're checking that urinary calcium level. So if the calcium isn't spilling over into the urine, they just have a higher set point. It's a benign familial hypocalciuric hypercalcemia, and the treatment is nothing. Okay, Kevin. Inferior thyroid artery supplies the parathyroid glands. Do they come in? Does the blood supply come in medially or does it come in laterally?
So the artery will be medial to the nerve.
Right. So the artery supplies the gland from the medial side. Why is that important?
Identifying the recurrent laryngeal.
Nope. It's for like when you're doing, we talked about when you're doing your subtotals and you're doing your half gland resection, are you going to resect the medial side of it or the lateral side of it?
You're going to resect the lateral side
of it. Right. So you don't disrupting the blood supply. So that way you don't end up with a dead half of a gland. Okay. So you're doing a neck exploration and you find three normal glands and you're missing one of the superior glands. Where are you going to look?
You check the retroesophageal space and open the carotid sheath.
Yep. So that's the superior one. Those are the two most common locations. So the retroesophageal space and open carotid. Now, how about you're doing a neck exploration? You find three normal glands and you're missing an inferior gland.
So this is more problematic as they are more varying locations for this. So you would first start with the ipsilateral side of the mediastinal thymus and then consider an intrathyroid gland.
Yep. And again, this is the most common, locations of these. How about if you find four normal appearing glands with an elevated parathyroid hormone?
You could consider hypersecreting supernumerary parathyroid gland, which is most commonly located in the thymus.
Yep. So you might have more than four glands. So most people have four glands, but you might have less, you might have more, and you might find four normal ones and your abnormal ones still out there somewhere. So most common location, now this is important. Okay. The word, this is one of those things where the wording of the question is important. So most common location of a missed gland. So you do your surgery, you don't find it.
Yeah. Parathyroids can be tricky to find. The missed gland is probably in its normal anatomic position.
Right. Okay. So slight distinction, the most important location of an ectopic gland.
The most common location of an ectopic gland would be the thymus.
I've definitely missed that on practice questions before. So they'll ask you read the question, most common location of a missed gland. You're like, oh, it's in the thymus. No, of a missed gland is the normal anatomical position of an ectopic gland is of the thymus. All right. Well, that covers it. It's about all the parathyroid I can handle for today. So that's parathyroid hormone. We'll see you, or parathyroid gland. We'll see you next time on Behind the Knife's Absite and Board Review.
Until next time, dominate the day.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.